So, hello everybody, and welcome to the Life Stories Podcast. My name is Ron Hogan from Beatrice.com, and we are podcasting tonight from Wix Lounge in Midtown Manhattan. Wix has been kind enough to host the space for us tonight. I'm here with Rachel Schuchert, the author of Everything is Going to Be Great. And we are also fortunate enough to have tonight's evening sponsored by Arcade Sunshine Media, a multimedia app developer who are actually recording some of tonight's proceedings for video as well. And we have Booked by Harriet here in the studio with us. So for those of you who, I guess if you're listening to this, you probably weren't here, but if you were here, you could have bought the books and had them signed by the author in person, and it would have been all thanks to Booked by Harriet. So now you know that for the next time that we have a live taping. So Life Stories is a podcast about memoir and memoir writers, and I've known Rachel Schuchert ever since her first collection of autobiographical essays, Have You No Shame, and her second book, here, Everything is Going to Be Great, is it's more of a sort of a straight through-line memoir. I mean, there's a single overarching story, but there are a lot of really interesting diversions within that overarching storyline. But I guess the first thing that I could ask you about, Rachel, is that, how is it that this story, none of this story ever ended up in your first memoir?
Well, there's kind of a Everything is Going to Be Great shaped hole in my first memoir. The first memoir was sort of based more on these sort of stories from childhood, and you know, it kind of coalesced around this theme of growing up in Omaha and being sort of an oddball there. And then it skipped ahead way beyond where I thought it was going to, because while I was writing the book, my grandmother died. And it became very clear to me that that was something that I really wanted to write about, kind of as it was happening in real time. But it was happening about, you know, 8 years in the future from where I planned to end the book. And in that middle time, everything that happened in this book had happened. I'd moved to Europe. I met my husband. I kind of went through this whole early 20s craziness. But it just felt like the story of my grandmother's passing and all of that was such a perfect bookend to this book that was sort of about childhood and then letting go of childhood. So that sort of wound up being this thing that I didn't expect when I had first conceived the book. And when I turned it in to my editor, she sort of was like, well, what happens in between this part and this part? Because, you know, all of a sudden I'm married and I'm a lot older. And for a while I sort of thought about trying to encapsulate everything that was happening in this book into one sort of chapter of Everything is Going to Be, of Have You No Shame. And then I began to feel like it really had like more of that, and it was its own narrative that I wanted to treat in its own book. So I kind of purposefully left it there, and it's sort of a prequel, I guess, to the very last chapter of Have You No Shame.
Well, set the stage for us a little bit. Where are you? What's going on in your life at the beginning of Everything is Going to Be Great?
At the beginning of this book, I had just graduated from college, and like a lot of people had, I think, no clue what I was supposed to do next. I had graduated from acting school, and it became very clear to me that I was not a very good actor, and that was probably not going to be a satisfying career path for me. I mean, the rejection is bad enough when you're actually good. So I was sort of floundering, and I wound up getting a part in this very serious sort of downtown experimental play with a very famous director who I don't name in the book, but if you know anything about downtown theater, you'll be able to figure out immediately who it is. And I figured if you don't know anything about downtown theater, then you won't know who he is anyway. So I might as well save myself the legal hassle of actually calling him by name. So I was cast in his play, and what it was sort of like a glorified stagehand kind of role, and was deeply humiliating in a lot of ways. We were sort of extras, and we didn't have speaking parts, but we had to rehearse 6 days a week full time for like 4 months, and were paid almost nothing. And I also was supposed to be a male. there were like male ones and female ones, and the female ones were both these sort of like models, like these sort of off-duty models, and then I was like lumped with the men which was wonderful for my self-esteem, especially sexually, as you can imagine, at this time in such a difficult place. So I wound up in that. But what happened with that, and the main reason I said I would do it, is because at the end there was going to be a European tour. I mean, this guy is sort of idolized in these pretentious European theater circles, and there's all these, so we're going to go around to all these different festivals that summer. And we began in Vienna at this big Viennese arts festival, which is, you know, just sort of utopian when you think about it compared to anything. I mean, these arts festivals in Europe are insane. They have these sort of temporary restaurants set up everywhere, and people go every day. I mean, it's incredible. So I was very excited about that. We got all kind of waved through customs together in a big group, the stage manager, and dealt with it all. And as I was going through, I realized that they didn't stamp my passport. There was no record of me having entered the European Union in a legal sense. So I thought, well, what if I just stayed here for as long as I can? And that's what I did. I wound up staying in Europe for about 2 years. It was a pretty crazy time where a lot of things happened, and that's sort of the story of the book.
Right, because after the theater tour, which covered Vienna and Zurich,
yes,
everyone else was heading back to New York. But tell me how you made the decision to stay and where you wound up.
Well, I really felt like there was nothing for me in New York. I was really sort of hating the person that I was becoming in the city, I think, of just getting very bitter before my time. And I really felt unemployable, and I felt like a loser. I felt everything, just everything terrible, like just completely in despair. So it wasn't a very difficult decision to not go back. But I'd have... Oh, the book actually opens in Paris. There's sort of a flashback scene in Paris, though, that you should, just to be clear. But I sort of felt like, you know, yeah, there was nothing I wanted to go back to. And I have these two friends that I'd met in New York sort of during the time that I was doing this play, who were these two Dutch theater directors, who are a couple, these two guys, who were trying to start this theater company in Amsterdam, which is actually like a very weird thing to do in Europe. I mean, here I feel like every drama graduate sort of graduates from school and immediately is like, we're going to start our own company and do our own shows. But in Amsterdam, the culture isn't like that. I mean, the drama programs are much smaller and everything is much better funded. So for them to actually be like trying to get something off the ground was sort of odd. But they were like, yeah, you can come and stay with us and we'll try to do a play together. And I think they thought I was going to be there for like 3 weeks or something, instead of living on their futon for close to a year. But they were never said anything, like, maybe you should leave, until I kind of found my way out. But yeah, I kind of took them up on that, and I took the train overnight from Zurich to Amsterdam and set up camp in their apartment.
And over the course of those 2 years, I mean, you had some pretty hair-raising experiences in retrospect. I'm thinking particularly of your teeth.
Yeah, you know, crazy things happen when you're sort of young, and I think especially when you're abroad, you're a lot more open to talking to weirdos than you may be on your own turf. Or maybe you're just much less adept at picking them out. You know, you're like, maybe he's not creepy. Maybe he just seems that way because he's foreign, and I don't know. I should be polite. And I don't know that, like, my creep radar was ever, like, very high at this time in my life. It kind of got... I got the callus going after time. Well, I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that it's good to be open to straight to weirdos, you know, at a certain point in your life. But yeah, some pretty strange things happened. I definitely met some odd characters. The story Ron is talking about involves I had a dental problem, and I fell in with a sort of group of Italian dental students who were also sort of swingers, which I didn't realize, and got into a difficult situation when I thought I was just going to get my tooth fixed. But it all turned out okay, and then it was very, you know, it was funny. Everyone was like, oh, it's going to be, you know, everybody Dutch, because I had, like, no money, and they were all like, it's going to be so expensive to get your tooth fixed. No, it's going to be, and I thought it was going to cost, you know, like in America, if you don't have dental insurance and you lose the cavity of your tooth, that's like $3,000. So I was completely panicking. And then I went, and I don't want to spoil the punchline for it in case you actually buy the book, because I give too many, I want to give too many details away.
Fair enough.
But it did involve a sort of date rape threesome almost. I managed to extricate myself out of by the fact of my horribly infected gum.
You know, one of the other things that jumped out at me as I was rereading this, because when this book came out in 2010, 2011, I remember reading it then, and then reviewing it for tonight's show, I had forgotten about, you know, I mean, so much of the book is, you know, madcap and zany, but there is a real edge to it, and I was thinking particularly of, you know, the chapter in Vienna, where it's like, you know, you're just out of college, you're like 22, 23 years old, and, you know, you're being exposed to Austrian anti-Semitism, which seems, I mean, you know, particular, it seemed much more...
Which is delightful.
Intensive.
It's much more civilized.
It seemed like much more intensive or intense than any other form you may have encountered.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. I didn't really encounter any growing up. You know, it wasn't something I was exactly prepared for. And it's, again, it was very, it's very weird. And I think, you know, Austrians as a whole, I think, have not really dealt with the war in the way that I think Germans have, for example. There's not really a sense of responsibility of having to come to terms with what sort of happened. You know, and it wasn't something I was expecting there. I wasn't, like, there, like, looking for that. But it was just odd to me, like, how it would sort of jump out. And what happened, ultimately, is I was at a flea market, and in the flea market in Austria, I found a yellow Star of David, you know, the patch one that was, like, in a box with some junk with, like, a bunch of comic books and, like, you know, things like that. And the guy I was with had, like, quite a violent reaction to it, and it was really surprising. But just the sort of little bits of lingering there, it was interesting. And the whole, that whole experience of being Jewish in Austria really made me aware of it in a way that I never had been before. And I think that that was a really interesting thing to kind of come to terms with. And a lot of it also, for me, became synonymous with coming to terms with my parents, mm-hmm. and letting go of a lot of anger I had in my relationship with them, because for me, my Jewish identity was so wrapped up with my family, you know, and any rejection of it was sort of rejection of them symbolically in some level. So I think that those two things kind of came together for me at the same time, and a lot of that happens over the course of the book.
And now, one of the things I'm really interested in your personal trajectory is, you know, how you make the transition from, you know, going to NYU studying acting, and we should say that you do still act, you know, occasionally.
Well,
but
in a very loose sense.
Yeah,
I'm acting right now.
But I'm kind of interested into how you made this transition from thinking that that was what you were going to do to essentially writing about your life and about other subjects as well. But yeah, you know, for the purposes of the books, you're primarily a memoirist.
Yeah, I mean, what happened for me, with writing, sort of about halfway through acting school, I realized I didn't really like acting anymore. I had been like a child actor, and I was pretty good at like that certain level of like child acting, you know, like I was an Annie a lot growing up as a kid and things like that. And then I sort of went to acting school because I didn't really know what else I was going to do. I wasn't a particularly great student in high school. I wasn't a very, very, you know, I was a sort of lazy student, frankly. It wasn't probably lack of ability on some, like lack of interest. So I kind of fell into going to acting school because it seemed like the best option. And about 2 years into it, I sort of was getting really fed up with it and feeling very exasperated creatively, and that it wasn't very interesting to me, and it wasn't necessarily something I could see myself doing forever, and I wasn't really sure what else I was going to do. But I sort of began writing kind of tangentially while I was in acting school, because I got very tired of listening to the same scenes and monologues and things again and again in class. So I would just write things and then pretend that they were from plays, like other people had written. Like I would do some bizarre monologue that I had like written down myself the night before, and the teacher would be like, "Oh, I haven't, what's that from?" And I would be like, "Oh, that's from the The Washingtonian Calumny by Hamilton Caldwell. Oh, it's a play from the 30s. I'm sure you don't know. I would completely make it up, and you know, sort of friends started to figure out that these weren't real plays, but I began to kind of feel like maybe I could actually write plays, because I liked writing them, and I felt so fulfilled performing something that I'd written myself, in a way that I never felt performing someone else's work. So I began to write plays, and it kind of happened that way, and writing about myself, it happened very naturally. You know, it seemed like when I first started writing for websites, for magazines, like that was what was very available to me at the time. You know, there was sort of like, I don't know, there was this sort of wave of like female writers coming in writing about their lives, and to me it felt very organic. Like I just sort of knew instinctively how to find that sort of beginning, middle, and end of every anecdotal thing, and how to find some bigger meaning in it, and how to make it funny. It felt very easy for me. And at some point not easy like in a pat, hacky kind of way, but just very natural. And I guess at some point you have to do what works, you know? But now that I've written these two books, I'm starting to move into writing fiction and into writing some stuff, television and film. And that is now very exciting because I feel like, you know, now that I've got this thing I'm so comfortable with and I sort of know exactly how to do it, I always like the challenge. I mean, that I actually think is the thing I've learned about myself the most from writing and just from life, is how much I genuinely like hard things. For a long time I felt, you know, and acting was definitely like this, and my decision to pursue acting was like this, was that it was like, well, that's just what I've always done and I can sort of fake my way through it, and had always really shied away from something that was a challenge, which is probably why I had such bad grades in high school. But I found this kind of new stomach in myself for, you know, wanting to do things that are hard.
And we've talked about this before, on the Twitter memoir chat in 2011. And then we were talking a little bit about this before that we started taping tonight, about in the context of, there's this new book called The Lifespan of a Fact, which is about an epic fight between a nonfiction essayist and his fact checker over all the creative liberties that the essayist took with historical accuracy in the course of writing his essay. And you know, when we talked about on Memoir Chat, you know, one of the things that came up with you and all the other writers that we were talking about is this sort of artistic relationship between, you know, what happened and our abilities to sort of represent or recreate what happened as we're writing memoir.
Well, I think the thing to remember is that already memory is so incredibly subjective. But even if you feel like you are sticking completely to the facts of what happened, you're not. You know, that somebody else that is there is going to have probably a different interpretation of a conversation that you had. They'll remember you wearing a different color sweater or being somewhere else. And who's to say who's right, you know? It doesn't, something after it happens doesn't exist anywhere except in your head. So your interpretation of it is sort of the only thing that matters. I also think that there's simply a practical element to it. You know, the idea, I always sort of describe writing memoir as, it's a bit like creating a sculpture out of found objects. Like you have all these things that are already there, and your job is to figure out how to arrange them in a way that transcends what they are and imparts some other meaning, you know, where they become more of just like a bunch of like little things that happen, and there's actually something deeper there. And sometimes you have to rearrange things a little bit beyond what they are to make them that, you know. So if you need to take something that somebody said that's the idea of something that they said, or something that they would have said, but maybe not exactly the thing that they said at that time in the particular scene that you're describing, I think that's fine. You know, if they told you this story one time, but you need them to tell them, you need them narratively to tell you this story now, then, you know, why not? It's not, no one is calling this like exact reportage. Like, it's not war reporting. Do you know? It's not, we're not reporting on politics. There's not, all it is you're trying to create something interesting and something beautiful and tell a compelling story that can mean something else to somebody else. And I actually think that is, when somebody's like, well, why should I care about something that just happened to you? I think that it's because you have to do that work to make them care. And then that's the way that you do it. You know, you say that you saw something that maybe you didn't see it exactly that time, but because it has like, you know, because there's a symbology to it that makes sense there, or you have a conversation with someone when you need to have it with them. That said, I don't think that it's exactly moral to do what some memoirs have done and just basically write a novel and say that it's true for sales purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because obviously it's easier to sell. I mean, I don't even know what the logic behind that is. Like, I feel like you get so much more credit for writing a novel that you wrote a novel. But I think it's okay to kind of take these snapshots and arrange them into something that is meaningful and that makes sense and that has a fluid structure.
And it's also come up in conversations that we've had about memoirs online about, you know, memoir as, I'm trying to think of the right word here, you know, a feminist platform or a feminist vehicle, but you know, memoir as a medium in which women can give voice to their experiences and to their conscience or consciousness of their experiences as well.
Yeah, well, I think I've always said that for a woman, just positing that she is inherently interesting is already a radical act on some level, because women really do still have a sort of harder row to hoe when it comes to proving that what they have to say is worthwhile. And to just say that this experience is interesting because I lived it and I have something to say about it, to me is very feminist. That said, I think that the same rules apply for male or female memoirs, the same that they do for novels, that it's not therapy. Like, you're not just sort of, it can't be this completely self-absorbed, you know, kind of Twitter stream. Like, there's got to be some bigger heft to it. But I think that for sort of my generation of women, deciding that their experience is something that other people can learn from in the same way that men have always done is very important.
And in terms of the reception, too, I think that it's interesting to see those sort of gendered differences in that. It's like, I mean, you know, imagine a memoir by a late 20-something man about how in his early 20s, fresh out of college, he went off to Europe and drank and had wild sex and, you know, bounced around Europe for 2 years.
Right, and then it's some universal coming-of-age story. I mean, I was talking about this. I was talking to another writer yesterday for a magazine, and I said I think part of why that is because people don't expect men to have any kind of emotional intelligence about their experiences. So when they do, all of a sudden they're a genius, where everyone expects women to talk about themselves all the time and be analyzing their feelings and what happened to them. So it's just like rote, you know, and it's not. And I think that we still do have this divide that really needs to change, where men are just people and women are women. And so when a man tells the same story as a woman, it's universal. And when a woman tells the same story, it's just for women somehow. And that is a problem that I think we see in every media. And hopefully it will begin to change. I think the only way is to continue to bombard the upcoming generation of men with images of women as their equals.
And you mentioned that you're writing a novel now. And tell me a little bit more about the transition for you. What are you noticing as a writer as the adjustment that you're making from writing fiction after writing memoirs for a while?
Well, I've noticed that it takes me a lot longer to write fiction. Because on some level it's a bit of a new discipline for me, and also there's just so much more research that goes into it. You know, when it's a lived experience, you already have the entire world there. When it's something that you have to invent completely part and parcel, you know, every detail is something else that you have to think of. And for a world in a novel to completely come alive, you really do have to think of every detail. You have to be able to imagine this entire room that you weren't in. You have to imagine this whole world and, you know, these people that aren't real people. What do they look like? How do they talk? What does their voice sound like? All of those things. It's a much more meticulous imagining, which is really fascinating, and you can really fall down the rabbit hole in a totally different way. But so that's been one big thing is that I don't just immediately have this image in my memory bank. And even when you base it on something, then you have to like figure out what you're basing it on. You know, there's all this extra work that has to happen. The novel I'm working on right now is structured in a certain way as a memoir. It's a memoir of a fictional person meeting fictional people, going through this story that is fictional. It would be like, you know, if you met this woman who's the first person narrator of this novel and was like, what would you write your memoir about? Then this is it. So, you know, but I do feel like I have a certain, if not a gift, at least like a facility with the first person voice, which isn't something that I feel like I want to give up, you know? I mean, I feel like it's more sort of like a novel like that Philip Roth writes in first person, you know? And even where, when it sort of switches into third person, it's still narrated by this larger framing device of Nathan Zuckerman or something like that. So it's kind of has some of the same skill set. Hi.
So we are being joined now by Rev Jen. Rev Jen is the author of Elf Girl, which is her memoir about coming of age. Well, I shouldn't say coming of age because it's, you know, in the 20s and all, in her 20s and all. But basically the art scene, on the Lower East Side in the 1990s and early 2000s. And, so I guess I will plunge right into it with you, Rev, and ask, you know, set the stage for us. Yeah, you know, tell us, you know, what's going on at the beginning of Elf Girl.
Okay, well, first of all, I apologize for my lateness, but I've had some events in my apartment, i.e. the boiler had a breakdown, and we were, like, gassed out of our apartment, and I've been delirious for 24 hours because of the fumes, if that's a good excuse.
I think that's a fair excuse.
And so what was the question? I'm a little loopy.
Oh, yeah, so we were just... set the stage for us about what's going on.
Okay. Elf Girl is, it starts in 1972 when my mother induced labor, she was pregnant with me, by riding the teacups at the Enchanted Forest Amusement Park in Baltimore, Maryland. And then the rest is history. And then it pretty much jumps from there to me coming to the Lower East Side and starting an open mic.
New York was, you were in school originally, and how did you make the transition, what was going on in the transition from studying the visual arts to becoming more of a performance artist?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, I came here, I'd gotten a scholarship. I didn't want to come to New York. Like, I kind of wanted to go to the Baltimore Art School, but I didn't get a scholarship there. Shit, I gotta go to New York? Okay. So I came here, and I painted. I stopped painting for 10 years, but now mostly what I do is paint. But, the transition was really that if you were in the painting department, you were expected to make paintings. Crazy. And I wanted to do a little bit of everything. And so I started a punk band with my friend Julia. And we started doing gigs around with, like, you know, other art students. And a punk band leads to performance art, I think.
And you had also studied with, there was a performance artist who was teaching at SVA who turned out to be fairly interesting. As well, right?
Yeah, Mike Smith, who I don't know if you guys have ever seen Baby Icky Goes to Burning Man. Mike Smith is possibly the most brilliant person on the planet. He always did this baby character, and he was a substitute teacher that ended up becoming the full-time teacher, actually. There was one performance art class offered at SVA, and really only the weirdest kids signed up for it. It was like, you got your painters and your sculptors, people who want to learn how to carve marble, and then you have people who want to learn to, like, pee on a poem, you know? And so those were the people in the performance art class, and they were wonderful. Mike Smith had this character, Baby Icky. He's a grown man, and he'd dress as a baby and basically go out. The video that I saw, and the thing is that it made me laugh so hard I fell off my chair, where he is dressed as a baby and goes out in the streets of Chicago, and he's playing with a ball, like a bouncy ball, and it bounces into traffic, and he stops traffic because, like a baby, he runs out and tries to grab it, and cars have to stop. And just the annoyingness factor plus the comedy of it made me laugh so hysterically that, yeah, Baby Icky. huge influence on me.
And that was right around the time that you kind of came into your own as an elf and became really the Reverend Jen that we've come to know over the last two decades.
What's interesting is that I've gotten less strange. As a child, I was even weirder. I mean, I think I wore things to school. Well, when I was a teenager, I discovered my mother's closet full of, like, Cher outfits from the 60s, right? And I just wore those to school, and that was, you know, traumatized people. But, no, I've actually gotten more normal. But one thing about art school, it helps you find your voice a little bit. And so when I got out of art school and I didn't have money for canvas or paints are expensive. It's terrible. I started writing. Also, I was working in art galleries, so I just sat down with my journals and wrote all the time, and that's kind of how I started becoming more and more of a writer. Also, I'd always been writing about my favorite artists throughout art school. Any chance I could get to take a class where I got to do creative writing, I took. Or art criticism. So I write for ArtNet now, although I would hardly call it art criticism. I basically survey whatever's going on and I write about it, you know. But the first book I did was Reverend Jen's Really Cool Neighborhood, published by Printed Matter, the Chelsea bookstore. Before that, I'd been hand-binding books with duct tape and glue and stuff and staples. And coloring books and things like that, and taking them there and selling them on commission. And they started selling to places like the Whitney and the Warhol Museum and things like that. And so when they decided to start a publishing program, they asked me to write a book. And I thought, I'll write a travel guide to the Lower East Side, because I've lived there for a long time. So I did that, and then the second book I had published, this is a little known fact, was through Scholastic, and it's called Best Friends for Life, Trolls with a Z, T-R-O-L-L-Z. Yeah, I did that book. It's a kid's book. It was one of those magical moments where you're at a party and someone says, hey, you're obsessed with troll dolls, and you're a writer. Would you like to write a book for kids about trolls? And you immediately say, yes. So that was my second book. And then Live Nude Elf was my third book, which was is about when I worked as a sex columnist for Nerve.com. And then Elf Girl is a prequel to that, because Live Nude Elf takes place basically 2004 to 2007. It doesn't span a very long time period, but Elf Girl's everything that led up to that.
So Live Nude Elf, you know, it has that sort of structure imprinted in it, in that it's, you know, you're starting with the basis of dealing with the columns and the experiences in writing the columns. So when it came time to do Elf Girl, how did you sort of, like, find your way into telling that story of your life?
Well, I'd already started to do it. I'd gone to London with the Trachtenberg Slideshow Family Players, the band, as their opening act. And I would just get on stage and tell stories, basically, every night before they went on and did their music. And a publisher in London left a big bag of chocolates and Budweiser in the dressing room with you should write your memoir. No, and will you meet with me thing. And so I met with publishers in London, and we talked about how I could write a memoir about my adventures, because at that point I hadn't really been putting them down on paper. I did things at the open mic. But when I got back, and that was, I guess, 2006, I just spent a few months putting it all into a book. And I already had a lot of the chapters, because I used to write for Shout, the magazine, great free magazine that was around for a while. And so I was writing, I already had a ton of them written out, and I just structured it. And then I tried for a while. I had an agent. I tried to get it published. It didn't get published. And then Live Nude Elf got published, which, of course, because sex sells, right? after that, it was easier to get Elf Girl published. To make a long, very long story short, because...
So one of the things that I love about Elf Girl is that, I mean, it really reads like a love letter to a distinctive period of, you know, the Lower East Side art scene, and kind of like the anti-art scene as you formulate.
Well, yeah, in a way, a love letter. What had happened was that when I got out of art school, I started working in established art galleries, and they were extremely boring. And I had been writing during downtime, and my friend Monica, who lived in Alphabet City, she said, well, you should go to Facebook's open mic at Collective Unconscious. And I said, what's that? And she said, I'll show you. And we went, and it was at 2nd and B. It was this great little art hole. And I walked in, and I just went, oh, this is where art went. You know, it was people doing things that were honest. They weren't trying to sell something. And the whole art gallery scene seemed to be about people trying to sell. And this seemed to be about people being real, telling stories, being honest. And I just fell totally in love with it. And after that first night there, I was so skeptical going in, because I had this feeling that, because poetry slams were so popular at the time, I thought I was going to walk in and it was going to be like, and then I did that poetry slam horseshit. And instead it was like 20 freaks just being freaks. And they were all really honest, really smart, talented human beings. Honest, heartfelt, hilarious. And I fell totally in love with the scene. And I thought, I'm coming back here every single week.
and it's something that, as you write about, you know, that kind of creativity and creative spirit, you really integrated that into, you know, everything else that was going on in your life. I mean, you talk about... particularly the kind of protesting that you were doing against the ways that Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor of New York City, was stifling creative expression, not just on the Lower East Side, but across the city. The way that you reacted to that really felt like a sort of like natural extension of the art that you were creating on stage at the clubs every week.
Yeah, we were doing satire and performance art, and when I learned about things like the cabaret law and that Giuliani was closing down bars because people were dancing, I thought the natural reaction to that kind of Kafka-esque insanity was to dance. our second dance action was we went up to the Richard Rogers Theater, I think it's called, in Times Square, and we were like, dance is not a crime signs and stuff, and we tried to dance inside the theater. And the cops came, but the cops actually thought it was hilarious, and we made a point of getting their names and things like that, so when we did events in the future, we had a liaison with the NYPD. Because the thing is, we wanted to do very peaceful, satirical protests with a very specific point in mind, which was that the cabaret laws are totally unlawful. And so I, at one point, got to speak at NYU Law School about them with the head of consumer affairs there. It's just because I really like to dance, you know.
So do you think Occupy could maybe benefit from some elves and dancing?
Well, when I think that Occupy, and I like when people shake things up, but I think that it was a movement, and it's still a movement, people are still doing stuff, but it spread too thin, and so objectives need to be made and they need to be met. When we did the Dance Liberation Front, we had one very specific objective, which was eradicate the cabaret law. We don't know how to do it through legal action, but we know how to get press attention. Because one thing that bothered me is that the Giuliani administration, they were closing down bars left and right, bars where I had been performing maybe for, I don't know, 2 drink tickets a night or like $5. It's living. And they were closing them down because of the cabaret law, which is more than 3 people dancing in an unlicensed venue, you can close it down. And they would close them down on a Friday night. So the bar would be closed all weekend. A bar loses a weekend's worth of wages. They're gone. You know, so it was really hurting small businesses too, which bothered me a lot. So I thought one thing that wasn't being reported was this. Like the press, the Voice, the nothing was reporting on it. There wasn't a single article about this. And so my best friend Faceboy and I and Robert Pritchard, who ran Surf Reality, we went, how can we get attention called to this terrible Kafka-esque crime that's being committed against people who just want to dance? The night that Baby Jupiter got closed down, like, the Yankees had just cinched the World Series, and so people were celebrating and dancing, and it just seemed so wrong. And we got together and we went, let's make a little kamikaze dance squad, and it'll get press attention, because press attention will hopefully get something done.
And change of pace question. So now, after 2 memoirs, do you have more sort of autobiographical writing that you want to do?
Yeah, I just wrote a novel. I'm not sure what it's called yet. I think it's going to be called June, so it's like without the Henry. And it's a novel about, it's a filthy novel, basically. And then the other one I'm writing is called Dick School. It's about when I worked for a sex therapist. But the novel June is done, and I'm not sure where that's going. I mean, I just want to paint right now. I'll keep writing books, but you've probably experienced this, Rachel, where you're just like, publishing is just exhausting.
Oh. Yeah, I was having one of those days yesterday where I was like, I think basically everything is like fine in general, but after today I've been so frustrated, I just want to like move away and open an antique store. Or so, just like anything.
So that concludes the formal questions that we had for y'all tonight. I want to thank everybody in the audience for coming to tonight's taping of Life Stories, and I want to thank you folks who are listening to this by podcast for tuning in to hear Rev and Rachel talk. Thanks, and have a good one.